Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg, and Kirk and I have got our coffee and are ready to talk about another thing that we've run into with just reliability engineering in general, but it also comes up specifically when a failure occurs. Now, on a previous episode, I was talking to Tim at that time, Kirk, and related that it was actually that morning that we were doing the recording that the refrigerator in my house had failed. Mm-hmm. Now, my first instinct was to go grab my toolkit and take the thing apart and start probing and, you know, do some failure analysis with the tools I have here at home. Sure. I restrained myself. My wife gave me that look, you know, and based on our last discussion about how do you know it failed? Well, there was no light. It wasn't making any noise. It was still relatively cool, so we don't think it had failed that much before we got up in the morning and went to do it, but it wasn't behaving correctly. But we noticed it right away. And so we called a repair guy, an appliance repair team, and they said, is the circuit – and my wife had already checked the circuit breaker. It was instinct for her. We checked the circuit breaker. I went and got a circuit tester and tested the wall socket, mm-hmm. but there was power to the wall, mm-hmm. But the refrigerator was still dead. So we suspected it was in the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. And when we called somebody, they asked us the same sequence of questions. Is the circuit breaker good? Is the wall circuit got power? All right. What other symptoms? Is there light? Is there a motor running? Is there anything going? And they said, all right, we got to come out and we suspect it's this, this, and this. We'll come out and check.
Right.
And that was actually exactly what I expected, right? But you and I and people that are listening to this podcast, we tend to deal with failures by it's a learning opportunity. We can go get something out of that.
Yeah.
But we've seen people, their first response is the refrigerator failed. I could have turned to my wife and said, what did you do to it? It's your fault. Right. How did you break it? Right. Blame somebody. Or we could have, you know, now I know more about the back of a refrigerator, but we see this in the lab all the time. Somebody says, oh, I know what the problem is. Let me try this solution. And then they put some duct tape on it and it works or doesn't work.
Right.
Yet what this guy did was a very systematic troubleshooting process. And he came out, he checked the circuit breaker, he checked the wall outlet, he probed it to make sure it had the 120 volts it was supposed to have. And then he started into the refrigerator and very systematically mm-hmm. looked through stuff. And then when we finally got the bad board out and replaced it, you know, we both took a very careful look at it. And we saw some open vias that had through-hole components in it that mm-hmm. had very partial solder. It was probably a marginal soldering on a handful of components. And so we suspected that was the issue, but we didn't have the tools to diagnose it further at that point. As much as I wanted to take it apart, apparently he got credit. Some part of his pay was based on returning bad boards, which was good. This manufacturer was looking for failed boards and was willing to pay for the return of them.
Right. That's a real problem is getting failed boards, especially when they're inexpensive or something like that. They are not sent back. They're just thrown in the trash. But you brought up a really good a fundamental is that it has to be a systematic way of going through the investigation of what is the cause of the failure, starting at one part of the circuit and making sure, and either going from where that failed, going back upstream, or you know that tells you which direction you're heading in the investigation. It's really important not to blame somebody, but it is important to understand what possible conditions, like did you hear a lightning strike the house?
That's right, or a tree fall across the power outside.
Or something like that, that would have caused a good explanation. Well, you probably had a spike, a transient into your power supply, or, you know, burned up a circuit
a fuse or a circuit breaker.
So those are the first things, you know, is first understand maybe what the conditions were. A lot of it is also, how old was your refrigerator? Was it a new refrigerator or was it an older one? If an older one, you might think, well, maybe the compressor finally gave out. So, you know, understanding some of those things. But it's also a matter of not making assumptions about that. For instance, and this is very common in a halt process and doing a post-halt failure analysis, that the assumption is that you took it over spec, so it has of course failed and you destroyed the components. And that's a poor assumption to limit you. If you go with that assumption, it will limit your investigation and you might just not get the really valuable information you need.
Well, that really goes back to that. You don't want to create blind spots for yourself. You don't want to rule out things. I mean, so my wife checked the circuit breaker. I checked the circuit breaker. The technician checked the circuit breaker. Mm-hmm. And none of us made that assumption that it was fine, that it wasn't the issue. And if it was the circuit breaker, we would have reset it and we would probably wondered why it tripped and would have had to go down a different path, but mm-hmm. we wouldn't have had to go buy a bunch of ice and find a bunch of coolers to store everything. Yet engineers do this all the time. It can't possibly be that I designed it correctly or it's never that. It's never that problem. Right. And they missed something as simple as a connector came out detached.
Right. So, and you know, an example of making an assumption might be a recent example of that my mother had with her PC. Now she's, you know,
I still got to get you on a Mac, you know, especially your mom. You guys.
Okay. That'd be a whole nother hour that we discussed this, but she had a problem with the fact that she couldn't find her cursor on her PC. And she had a previous problem where with her lost email or lost address book that some firm she'd called to come out and help her at quite an expensive rate had done that and fixed it. And it was a problem that I couldn't have troubleshot over the phone very easily. But then she just recently had her couldn't find her cursor, or cursor wasn't showing on the screen. She, not knowing and being non-technical at all, but actually when she called for help to the same firm, she suggested that maybe the batteries were dead in the mouse. And the technician over the phone said, no. Well, he says, do you have a light on your mouse? And she says, yes. She says, okay, then it's not the batteries. I'll have to send somebody out. Well, she had somebody come out for $100 an hour. And she said after about 20 minutes, couldn't figure out why couldn't find the cursor on the screen. And my mother, in her late 80s, gave it away, suggested the same thing she suggested to the guy on the phone was, maybe it's the batteries. Well, guess what? She went and got two AA batteries, put it in the mouse. The guy tech put it in the mouse, and it was working. So maybe there was a whole bunch of assumptions that went behind that guy, that the caller had said, oh, don't worry about it. I already confirmed with her. It's not the batteries because the mouse.
Well, the person in the truck was, they probably rarely see it's a battery problem because most people, would just, and this is, I think, a more subtle point is when you're confronted with something you don't know much about, one response is, well, I don't know what I'm doing, hands off. I'm just mm-hmm. not sure, so I'm going to do nothing. Now, There's some people that have the opposite response, which is equally as bad, is that they try everything, right?
Right. Not systematically. And during that time, they're really getting confused.
Right. And so you don't know what fixed or what you need to reset back to where it was. It just makes a mess. Now, you and I have that experience, but we've seen responses on both ends of the spectrum. So your mom's response was, you know, this is technical. This is beyond me. I asked somebody on the phone. They ruled out the mouse. And, you know, it took a while then for her to actually, but why
yeah,
didn't
but
she?
But her first assumption was actually correct.
Right, but why didn't? But the question is then why didn't she just change the batteries to start with?
Exactly.
And there's that little bit of I'm not sure piece that probably prevented her from taking that step just to try it, run that experiment.
Right, and somebody she had respected as a more knowledgeable person had told her that wasn't the problem.
That's right. So it created this artificial blind spot for the eventual failure analysis work. Right. And so part of what we're, I think what we're talking about, Kirk, and what we advise our listeners to do is find that middle spot, is be systematic in it, you know, break down your system into what it's supposed to do and what parts are working, what parts are not working. And what's the, whether it's like my refrigerator, it's from, do we have power to the house? Do we have power through the circuit breaker? Do we have power to the wall circuit? Do we have power across the cable that goes into the refrigerator? Because he probed that next. Then he went into the control board and isolated that he had power to the board, but no power coming out of the board. There was no signal going anywhere else after this control board.
All right.
So he was able to very systematically trace the, based on the symptom of no power, right? There's no lights, no compressor, no activity at all. The symptom was suggesting that it was power. So he traced that flow of where the power comes from all the way from basically the cable, the connection to the street. And, and very systematically went through and isolated it. And it only took him a few minutes, actually. Whereas if we would have just... If he would have showed up and says, well, I'm going to replace the compressor, I'm going to replace the circuit control board, I'm going to replace all the wiring, and he plugged it back in, it probably would have worked, and it would have cost me about as much as a new refrigerator, right? And I don't know what actually fixed it. So I was really encouraged by this guy's approach of, if I can fix it for free over the phone, I will. One, I thought that was... You know, instead of saying, oh, it's going to cost you $200 for me to show up, he said, try this, this, and this. Okay. Sounds like we got to come out. Then they were very systematic on it, and they replaced the one part, what they could replace at the board level, and it worked.
Right.
So it was – but we see this in the lab is – and with design teams and with people is that – people may not overtly say, oh, it was George's fault. He's such a horrible designer. You know, I gotta go fire him. He's terrible. No, we don't tend to do that overtly. Yet, if we lean towards the idea of blaming somebody, we create blind spots as to what's really going on.
Exactly. And so all the things that we've talked about as far as our personal experiences in the house and equipment and with my mother are certainly it's true in the manufacturing and design field too. The systematic approach without blaming somebody or making assumptions on why something failed is a very important to coming up with the correct root cause in doing a failure analysis.
That's right. And, you know, there's being sensitive to what could fail. And we talked about this in the last episode, is that it's by doing the proper planning, measuring what you expect is going to fail and being open to what could fail. And then as you do the failure analysis step, which is critical in any kind of testing, if something doesn't work right, then why? And there's tools like 5Whys, there's failure analysis techniques, and there's fracas systems for managing all that. And yet it's, you need to get it down to some engineering understanding of what happened. And sometimes it's pretty novel. You might discover something new or interesting.
Right. And then there are cases, it's very difficult. Troubleshooting and failure analysis can be a very treacherous path in the fact that you may actually, by your disassembly, remove the cause of the failure. For instance, fretting corrosion on connectors. By plugging in a connector and reseating it, you may have actually removed the oxide coating on the surface of the connector pin that would have that caused the impedance, high impedance. So it's failure analysis is not an easy process. Many times.
It can be fun.
It's a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun.
It's like an investigation. It's like a murder investigation.
Or that's right. CSI.
Crime investigation. Yes.
CSI reliability. I can see the episode coming out anytime now. But it's, so let's wrap this one up. The notion here is, and the idea for this episode came when Kirk and I were chatting and just catching up, and we talked about these two different events that occurred to us recently. And realize that we see this at work too. And so we wanted to highlight that. And the takeaway really is, you know, failure analysis is important. It's what allows you and your engineering team to really make a difference based on the results that you're finding, the things that cause failures, and you want to mitigate or eliminate those. But you really need to understand them, and the failure analysis is critical to it. So isolating and understanding it is a piece of that. And we can get into more detail on in the ways of doing failure analysis, tools and techniques and so on. But I think this was a one that we see way too often that precludes us even getting to an understanding. And that's an important piece of it.
Right. It blocks our path to the understanding that we need to have to correctly address the problem and prevent it from happening in the future. That's kind of the fundamentals.
Exactly. So anyway, I think it's time to refill our coffee or move on to our next topic. But before we do that, let me ask you as the reader or the listener, I should say, that if you enjoy these episodes and stuff, let us know. We'd love to hear that. We have been getting a handful of questions, and some of the episodes are addressing those topics or questions. And if you've got something you'd like us to talk about, let us know. You can find the episode pages on reliability.fm, which will take you to a page that lists the podcasts in the network. And one of those is Speaking of Reliability, and you can see the most recent episodes there. And there's ways to leave a comment there. You can also leave a review on iTunes and leave a note or a comment to us what you think about an episode or about the whole program. But we'd really like to hear from you.
We want the feedback, and that's the way we make a better podcast.
Yeah, exactly right. All right, Kirk, well, let's get on the rest of our days, and we'll be back with the next episode.
Okay, thanks, Fred, for having me, and we look forward to speaking more about reliability soon.
Great. Thanks, Kirk. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.